show that looks at Kansas City baseball's past, present, and future.
High fly ball. Motley going back to the track. No outs to go. The Royals have won the 1985 World Series.
Davis comes to the plate. Strike three called. It's over. They've done it. The Royals are World Series champions. The world champion Kansas City Royals.
This is the Kansas City Baseball Vault.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome in to the Kansas City Baseball Vault, brought to you by Kelly's Westport Inn, a Baseball Prospectus affiliate. Folks, it's been a little bit. We had to miss a week. It happens. And we had to delay this week. But we're back and ready to roll. We got some things to talk about. So we'll get ready to that in just a few minutes. Before that, though, of course, introductions. I am Jeff Hur. With me, as always, is the man who needs no introduction, but we'll do it anyway, Michael Engel. Mike, how are you doing on this evening?
I'm pretty good. Introductions are free, so we might as well use them.
Yes, absolutely. Yep. We got some Royals things to talk about, and then kind of the main meat of the show this week. We've got an interview with Clint Scholes from, you may know, from BP Kansas City, the Royals prospect guru and general, I still don't know how he does it. It amazes me. The general high school player, young prospect player knowledge guru. He knows the Royals system for my money better than any employed by the organization person knows any other organization farm system. And additionally, if you want to talk draft, you ask him about any high school player, any college player, he's got something. He may have varying degrees of knowledge for different players depending on who they are and who he's been able to talk to, but he's got something. He knows who it is. He knows he knows enough about them to drop some knowledge on you. And that's what he's going to talk about in the interview in the second half of the show, some possible draft options that the Royals can have, who they could go with, what the draft is looking to shape up like, because the draft is in just a couple weeks here. What is it, June 6th? Is that the
date? June 4th, 5th, and 6th.
4th, 5th, and 6th. Okay. Yep. So that's in about a week and a half for that. And then so what we're going to do is we've got Clint on tonight to talk about, possible avenues for the draft with the Royals. And then we're going to actually have him again following up. So the week after the draft, or I guess if it'll the week of the draft, depending on how I haven't looked, what are those dates in terms of days of the week. But if it works out that we can have him on that same week of the draft, we'll do it. I think we ran that by him and he said he could do that. Right.
Yeah. It's tentative. We didn't.
We didn't figure
about the week of or week after, but there's going to be a Clint Scholes draft recap coming bookend this episode.
Absolutely. Either that week of the draft or the following week. So, if you're getting anxious because the play on the field is not keeping you all that involved, which is totally understandable, if you're getting anxious for some good positive Royals stuff, the draft is the epicenter of positivity. There's always hope that the guy you draft could be that next guy. Mike Moustakas was a draft pick at some point. Eric Hosmer was a draft pick at some point. So, those people, you always have that hope that they could become that next guy, that kind of face of the franchise. And the Royals got a lot of draft picks coming up that they can use to get that person, that next guy for this team, and the next few guys, hopefully, to start a wave so that we can get kind of a 2012 thing going again, where all of a sudden all these people start coming up and start maturing and turning into really good baseball players, and then it becomes a playoff team. That's the goal for every franchise, of course, but with this draft especially, if the Royals hit on this draft, then things could turn around a little bit more quickly than maybe we think. But if they miss on this draft, it's going to be bad. So
yeah,
not to put too fine of a point on it, but they need to hit on this draft. You know, not everybody. You don't have to. It's impossible to have 40 rounds and 40 players selected and have all the all of them be successes and valuable. You know, but you want, especially with as many top 60 picks that the Royals have, you want to see, you know, three or four legit everyday starters from that group that you would hope could be come up and start in the next few years. So yeah, that's your goal. And we'll see, you know, Clint's, like I said, he knows better than just about anybody what those, who those players can or might be and who the Royals got his kind of his finger on the pulse of what the Royals think and know. So that'll be the second segment. Before we get into that, we'll just kind of catch up since it's been a couple weeks. We've got, unfortunately, not all that much positivity to report. I guess here's something. The Royals do not currently have the worst record in baseball. That that crown, if you can call it that, upside-down crown perhaps, belongs to the Baltimore Orioles, who, you know, incidentally beat the Royals in the series that they've played. So don't know what that tells you about the Royals and where they stand. Technically, they have more wins than the Chicago White. Well, not technically. They do have more wins than the Chicago White Sox, but technically, you know, based on the amount of games played, their record is worse. So it's, you know, we keep hoping for these bright spots to come up from the team. And, you know, there's some individuals that kind of, we've talked about them in the past couple, the past few shows, you know, Jorge Soler doing so well, but he's kind of started to come back down to earth a little bit. Alex Gordon showing some life and he kind of came back down a little bit though. You know, recent games, he looks like he's starting to heat up maybe a little bit again. You know, Sal Perez still doing well. Mike Moustakas still doing well. But those things that are kind of expected, you know, those are known commodities. The unexpected bright spots, you know, are still few and far between. But we've got a few that have popped up now since the last time we've talked. So, you know, we talked about how the Covey and Herrera's having a nice comeback season. And, you know, I heard Buster Olney on A10 this morning talking about, you know, trade value for relievers, especially top-end relievers like Kelvin Herrera is. And the kind of consensus was, well, you know, the Royals could get a, depending on obviously, you know, who the willing trade partners are, I mean, the Royals could get a top 50 overall prospect for a Kelvin Herrera, you know, depending on who the team is and if
they,
that's what they have
could
to
use one.
Yeah, they absolutely could. So, you know, that's probably going to be the most interesting storyline to follow, Kelvin Herrera, because he is probably the most valuable commodity that they have as of today.
Yeah.
That is that the Royals are more than willing to part with. I think, you know, he's top of the list as far as, hey, who would the Royals be okay with, you know, sending away for some future pieces? You know, I mean, Salvador Perez would be a really good trade chip, certainly, but the Royals are going to be far more unwilling to trade him just because it's Sal Perez, which, mm-hmm. you know, I kind of understand. But, you know, and then Mike Moustakas would be, theoretically, the idea of Mike Moustakas as a trade piece sounds a lot better than the actuality of realizing how many people just, or how many teams just don't need third basemen. And so, and don't specifically, Mike Moustakas is kind of in that nebulous area where you say, I think there's a lot of teams that would love to have him on their team, but not a ton of teams that would love to give up a lot to get him.
Yeah.
He's good enough that if he's on your team, great. But he's not good enough that you say, you know what, he's worth sacrificing X in order to get. You know, he's not the he's not that Ben Zobrist guy that you think, okay, we get him and we can make a run at this thing, you know.
Yeah. He big would time difference help. Maker.
Yeah, he would certainly help a team, but he's not gonna be your difference maker, like you said. So we've got another, you know, month and a half to see how all that stuff plays out with the trades. But it's gonna start heating up, those rumors and things like that. And who yeah. knows? You know, the if you had to look at a team that would be one of the first movers, you know, Royals are definitely a good bet of who they could be. But you know, other bright spots, you know, Brad Keller has actually turned himself into a bit of a bright spot for the Royals. You know, I like he's just looked really solid. I'm gonna pull up his stats so I can read them off here. My browser's flipping out, of course.
Yeah, I mean, he hasn't given up a run since April 28th. He's only given a run up in four different appearances. The one kind of thing that I might ding him on is that his strikeout rate isn't super high, but I mean, he just goes out there and attacks. He's efficient with his pitches. He doesn't give up, you know, he's given up one homer all year. This guy was in Double A last year. So he just comes out and he looks every part like a guy who belongs. And that's pretty impressive as a Rule 5 guy. You know, you never know what you're going to get with those kind of players. And he's jumped right out. And it's kind of amazing that the Royals were able to get him. Like, I mean, that's kind of the thing that's come out on every article about him is like, holy crap, how did the Diamondbacks leave this guy available? Because he's coming out and he absolutely should be in the big leagues. He's showing it every time he goes out there. So he's been really impressive. And that's a big bright spot, especially when you're looking at guys like the Royals where the bullpen was so rough for so long. And this 22-year-old kid is who stabilizes it, you know. And not just him, you know, Tim Hill's been pretty okay. Birch Smith has been pretty good here and there. Jason Adam, he gave up a couple of homers, so he finally gave up some runs. But, you know, he's striking out 12 per nine, and he's not walking guys, really. So, you know, some of these young players are coming up and starting to make a name for themselves, and they're showing zero fear as they do it. So that's pretty encouraging, especially when you start out with, you know, a bullpen ERA of 900 or whatever it was. You know, the first month. It was really bad there, and it's really stabilized over the last, you know, throughout basically the whole month of May.
Yeah. I mean, even, you know, Kevin McCarthy is looking pretty good as well. And, and you know, Brian Flynn still doesn't look super great, but he's stabilized a little bit, you know, much better than he started. So, I mean, yeah, it's really interesting how the bullpen is starting to kind of take shape a little bit. And you can see, you know, as opposed to what's going on with the starters and the offense, you know, you can, as of right now, it looks like you can see a little bit more of a future with the bullpen, especially with the emergence of Brad Keller, who, I got his stats pulled up. He's got 20.1 innings, 1.77 ERA, which, and you know, to your point, the strikeout to walk ratio, he's got 13 strikeouts, 6 walks, so you'd like to see that a little bit higher than where it is from a ratio standpoint. But a 1.08 WHIP. I mean, he's looking pretty good, and you know, with the his numbers align. You know, sometimes you say, oh well, you know, the peripherals are a little bit worse, so maybe he's going to come back down to earth. But his peripherals all look in line with what he is, so he could be the real deal, and you know, as he continues to progress, you hope maybe that strikeout number increases a little bit. And, you know, he could turn into one of those top line guys. And yeah, it is pretty, pretty amazing. You know, the Royals, they've had some decent luck with Rule 5 guys, obviously the most famous being Joaquin Soria. But you know, Nate Adcock, he didn't turn into anything super great, but you know, that first year he was decent. He had some big innings for the team. So you know, the Royals have had some decent luck with Rule 5 guys, so this could be another feather in their cap in terms of that particular portion of the draft. So, yeah, that's been fun to see.
I mean, when you're I think they opened the day 13 games under? No, it was more than that.
17, 16, Seven, and 30.
Okay, 17 games. Yeah, below 500. I mean, it's been rough, and they went through a stretch where they got swept by Tampa, and then they had to play the Yankees, so that's real cute. But they did end up, they took the series in St. Louis, which that's always fun. I love beating the Cardinals.
Yes.
Like, always. Like, that's the best, you know. The Royals have two series wins this year, and one of them is against St. Louis. Perfect.
Take that.
Fine with that.
If, like, it was the only win, I'd take it.
It's just fun that way. Yeah, I mean, not a ton of bright spots. I mean, Jake Junis has been good. He's kind of come back a little bit after his first three or four starts, but that's expected. Jason Hamill had a good start in there. But yeah, the starting rotation's been rough. Danny Duffy still hasn't really gotten it back together. The main thing has been the way the bullpen has rebounded. That's the biggest bright spot to me, you know, where you look at a team that was so bad, and just by changing it up, you know, Kevin McCarthy comes up, Brad Keller gets an expanded role, Jason Adam makes it up. You know, you take away Brandon Maurer. I mean, these are the kinds of things that really kind of turned it around to where it's almost a functional group. You know, Kelvin Herrera doesn't have a walk all year. Didn't realize that. Someone mentioned it on his last appearance, and I'm sure it was going to be a jinx. And no, he just mowed through. He's just, you know, he gets the ball, and 12 pitches later, he's finished it off. It's pretty great, you know, and
yeah.
You know, to your point, that really does make him valuable. One, he's got a track record. Mm-hmm. You know, when we're talking about trades, he's closed games, he's set up games, he's pitched in the playoffs, he's pitched in huge spots in the playoffs,
mm-hmm.
and he's performed through all of it. He's having a great season right now, and it's a position of need that every team will always need. Like, you might not necessarily need a third baseman. You could probably find some guy who could handle third base for you. So that brings Moustakas' value down a bit. Plus Josh Donaldson, Manny Machado. If you're the Cubs, if you're the Yankees, the Angels, and you want that guy, you know what? Those are guys who are in play for you. Mm-hmm. You don't necessarily need to go after Moustakas. But Herrera, if you've got a guy who's got a good slider, a good changeup, and a fastball in the upper 90s with experience closing, that's going to get some return. And that he's definitely, like you said, he's their most valuable trade chip right now. So
especially when you look at a team like, you know, the defending world champion Houston Astros, who have a player like Kent Giles, who is having a kind of up and down season. And you think, okay.
And a bad playoffs besides.
Yes. Yeah. So, I mean, that seems like a real good landing spot for someone like Kelvin Herrera.
I'm good with it.
Yeah, and the Astros have a ton that they can work with because they stockpiled draft picks for years and years and trade chips and everything. So they've got some things that they can give up. So that, you know, that's a decent option right there. But just to your point, but then when you talk about Mike Moustakas, you look at more value from a Mike Moustakas over a Chesler Cuthbert or a Kelvin Herrera over who you have. You know, it just kind of depends. But I think a lot of teams would look at the Kelvin Herrera and, you know, who knows? Maybe that was kind of a bad comparison because Moustakas is pretty much better than Chesler Cuthbert. But you get what I'm going for here, where, like you were saying, you know, it's not super hard to find a third baseman who can just not shit the bed out there.
Right.
And
hit him eighth or ninth, and if he plays defense and occasionally hits a homer, you can live with it. You know, if it's a complimentary piece, fine. You know, it's if you're looking for someone to sit number 3, 4, 5 in your lineup, I mean, Moustakas can do that, but you're not necessarily going to give away, you know, 3 of your top 10 prospects to get him, especially when it's only half a year. That's the other thing, and we've mentioned this last season and even the season before a little bit, I think, is that, you know, the trade value at the deadline has been coming from those players that have multiple years of control, and the rentals aren't necessarily bringing back what they maybe used to back in, like, the 90s and such, with the exception of guys like, you know, like Ben Zobrist, who was... Mm-hmm. like the perfect piece for that team and the last piece that made them world champions.
Yep.
And you know, the Royals at the time, they gave up Sean Manaea, who now it, you know, a lot of people will lament that, and that's totally fair because Manaea has been very good this year, but at the same time, he had questions then, and it was an upside play by the A's. So even in giving him up, it's not like the Royals traded away a surefire thing to get Zobrist. And you look at what the Royals gave up to the Reds. You know, John Lamb's not with the Reds anymore. He's, I think he was suspended for the first half of the year and really hasn't, you know, done much. Brandon Finnegan was optioned earlier this season. He's had a lot of injury issues. Cody Reed's just kind of been up. He's just kind of a guy. So the Royals gave up one guy, and they got Johnny Cueto and Ben Zobrist for half a season. And, you know, on paper, yeah, they're names, but it's like when it really works out, sometimes the talent isn't always there. And that's true of any trade, but, you know, I think those rentals become, you know, guys where you expect the deals to be like Jeff Bagwell for Larry Anderson kind of stuff, mm-hmm. where, oh, this guy's going to be a future Hall of Famer. You know, you trade him for, you know, a middle reliever for him. You know, it just doesn't end up working out that way that often. So when you get a guy like Herrera who's really valuable, that's cool. That's, you know, go cash in on that. When it's Mike Moustakas who has value, get what you can, but, like, you can't expect to get a ton, especially when, you know, like you were kind of alluding to, the if you've got kind of an average-ish guy, you can probably get by with that. You don't necessarily need to go trade for someone. And you definitely don't need to trade a ton for him. But I think the Royals will trade him anyway, because you're not going to get a draft pick next year for Moustakas.
Yeah, you might as well get something. Moose, the production that he's had this season and the kind of player he is, he deserves to be on a better team right now. He can provide more value to a better team. So
it's true.
Hopefully hopefully it works out best for both. Hopefully he gets to be on a better team who's in the race, and hopefully the Royals get something in return that can help them in the future, because Mike Moustakas won't. That's just how it is.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, it'll be tough to say goodbye to him again, but
yeah,
we've been there. I mean, we've covered that, and the Royals will get more in return. You know, I mean, if they can get, you know, I would say, if you can get someone who's, you know, maybe top 20 of a team's prospects, maybe that's about the same as getting, you know, a pick that would have been number 35 in the draft. You know, it's tough. Or even then, Moose wouldn't have drawn a pick that high. He would have been in the probably 60s. So you're looking at like a third round pick. Yeah. That probably ends up working out pretty okay for everybody. He won't get his 40 homers in Kansas City, though.
No.
So, you know, I think the Royals won't pause on that. You might.
Yeah.
If it came down to it.
Ugh, I want it so bad.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Danny Duffy for a little bit. Okay. So, objectively, right now, one of, if not the worst, full-time starting pitcher in Major League Baseball. I haven't fully checked on that statistically, but a 6.88 ERA from 51 innings, I can't imagine there's many starters who have that long of a leash to where they'd be allowed to do that over that period of time. So there's been a lot of things being said about Danny Duffy and what's going on with him. And, you know, he himself has been concerned that he was tipping pitches, and, you know, people have been concerned maybe he's hurt, his release point is off, maybe he's been affected, he just doesn't have the velocity, you know, it's up and down. Excuse me, he doesn't have the movement on, you know, all his off-speed pitches like he used to. What's going on? I don't think anybody truly knows, including Danny Duffy, which may in fact be the issue, you know?
Right.
I made this comment in our Slack chat, and I think it's about Duffy that, you know, because of what we know from Duffy's history and how inside his own head that he is, and how much he, you know, how big of a focus and a hurdle the mental game is for him, because of what we know with that, it almost seems like for Danny Duffy, it's worse for him to think that he's tipping his pitches than if he was actually tipping his pitches. Because, you know, I think he's got a good enough stuff that even if he was tipping his pitches, he'd still be, you know, doing well enough. But if you think you're tipping your pitches, then you're going to try and change your mechanics, even if it's just subconsciously, to try and find a way to no longer tip your pitches, if that's what you think you're doing. And so if that's where Danny Duffy's at right now, and he thinks he's got this problem, and he's consciously or subconsciously trying to fix it, you know, that could be just doing a multitude of things. And then you start to wonder, and this is, you know, a little bit more prevalent, I think, for pitchers, but also still has the same issue for hitters. You know, after something's been wrong for so long, if it is a mechanical thing, like he's changed his release point or he's losing his release point or whatever the case may be, there's got to be a worry that if it goes on for too long, then it's even harder to get back. You know, it may never be able to get back because your body has gotten so used to new mechanics that it's just even harder to come back to where it was before. So, you know, and that's why you see those kind of phantom DL stints, etc., where you know, players essentially just need some time off and they can focus. Okay, here's the mechanics I know are good. Let's study some tape of when I knew everything was okay and I was doing well. I need to get back to that, and I just need to trust myself. And, you know, it's just Duffy's all over the place. And when you not only physically but mentally, when you hear an interview with him, you know, interview after his last start, I mean, he was just very self-deprecating. He was, I sucked. I need to do better. You know, this is embarrassing. I've never had this happen before. It's obvious he's frustrated, and he should be. I totally understand why he would be. But, you know, what are the options here? How does this get fixed? I don't know that anybody knows. And I heard that, listening to Day 10 again, you know, they have Mike Boddicker on there, who's obviously a pitcher when he played. And, you know, they asked a question, which I thought was kind of interesting. And Mike Boddicker's opinion was that the Danny Duffy had – it's a release point issue and a landing issue. So, like, where his foot is actually landing, which then, you know, they're kind of interrelated, because if you don't have a consistent landing spot for –
your release is going to be off.
Exactly. Yeah. So and so they asked him, well, do you think that's something that Dave Island would have addressed, and maybe Cal Eldred is not addressing that, and that might be part of the issue? And he said yes. They didn't really expound on that, at least from what I – so, you know, I don't know what there is to that. And I don't know if that means that Eldred is not addressing it, or maybe it's just Duffy's not being able to correct it because of some other reason. Yeah, I honestly don't know. But it is kind of interesting that Duffy had Island as his pitching coach basically his whole career, and definitely for the best parts of his career. And, you know, Island leaves and he's had easily the worst season of his career. So it could be related, could not be related. Too early to tell at this point. But, I mean, I don't know. I don't have any answers for him. He's going to pitch coming up here. And
he's going tonight again, so far.
He's tonight, yeah.
So far he's scoreless.
So, I couldn't. Couldn't remember if it was tonight or tomorrow.
So there's that, but yeah, I don't know what it is either. I mean, they talk about like tipping pitches, and I think Brian McCray was like, "Oh, he's 1 inch behind, you know, 1 inch farther back." And I'm just like, I don't know that is really that noticeable. Like, I mean, I think you can definitely tell if a guy is throwing a slider out of a 3/4 and everything else, you know, fastball, changeup is overhead. Okay, yeah, that might be something that'll tip when it's not for effect, like a guy dropping down sidearm, you know, like Bruce Chen used to do on occasion, you know, where it was intentional. It was intentionally giving a different look, you know, when it's just a habit.
Didn't David Cohen used to do that?
Yeah.
That he'd drop down real low and do that sidearm thing.
Yeah, a lot of guys will break that out just as like just one more wrinkle. Mm-hmm. And like when it's intentional, that's different. But when it's like a habit, then sure, yeah, I think that would be tipping pitches. But I don't think like 1 inch difference is enough when, you know, you're talking about gearing up for a split second decision of to swing or not. It's pretty tough. Not that it can't be that, but it just stretches a little farther than I would kind of go with. Jesse Newell at the Star had a post up today that was he overlaid delivery from a game last year and a game earlier this season of Duffy, and the motion looks about exactly the same. The difference is one of them, the slider drops and falls off the table. The other one stays up and gets hit about 400 feet. So, you know, if it's just command of that one pitch, that might be the only adjustment. I don't know if that's an island, island Eldred kind of thing that's going to cause that problem or not. But I do know that we haven't heard as much about Cal Eldred's approach as a coach. For those kind of things, whereas Island was, you know, very much reportedly someone who was going to be finding those small things in mechanics, fix Jeremy Guthrie and help the other players. I don't want to blame Eldred or the Royals for dropping Island, but I mean, that definitely could be, especially if it's someone that you're, you know, a coach that you're used to working with, who might be able to help him get past whatever that block is that's making him either too fine or, you know, just that little bit off on throwing a slider. And like, that's the main thing. It was a pitch that was great for him 2 years ago, and now it's his worst pitch. And that's significant. And maybe it is something where he's thinking in the back of his head and trying to be way too fine with it, trying to locate it differently or trying to grip it differently. I mean, that stuff can add up, but I don't know what the answer is either. He's been bad, and he's been, you know, back to the old like 25 pitch per inning type of player that he was, you know, early in his career, which is not helpful to him or the Royals. He does beat himself up about it, and he's taken accountability for performing poorly, but you know, there is a certain point where he's almost like he's kind of just got to fall back into the cliches a little bit, maybe, and just let it work itself out. I think ultimately he'll probably be okay, but I mean, I don't know. I mean, there's nothing that says that, yes, he's definitely going to be okay. It's just that, you know, he's got this real big issue with a pitch that was able to be relied upon and now is a real liability. And, it's how you enter a game in late May with a 6.88 ERA.
Yeah.
So
it's, you know, and if you came into the season or as we came into the season, you know, and you kind of talked about, since we knew the Royals weren't going to be that competitive and who the trade chips might be and who had the highest trade value, Danny Duffy would have been near the top of your list, relatively young. He's not as young as he used to be, obviously, 29 now, but still in his prime, technically. Left-handed pitcher who's had, you know, a history of success and has that top-level talent that we all know. And he's got a very team-friendly contract for multiple years. So all of those things put together make someone like Danny Duffy a very valuable target in a trade deal. But that value has almost completely eroded at this point. And, you know, I think that he's still got a couple things going for him in the sense that obviously he's got a good track record. And I think teams would be willing to give him the benefit of the doubt when looking to trade for him. But at the same time, you know, it's still there that this is the bad season that he's had. What does that mean for his future? Is it worth giving up a lot for this year and a few future years when who knows what you're going to get from him? And it's unfortunate because we like Danny Duffy a lot, you know, everyone does in Kansas City. So it's tough to see him go through something like this when, and, you know, as you said, he's taken the appropriate accountability, but that, you know, that only goes so far. You needs to see some improvement, and unfortunately we haven't seen that from him yet. And I tend to fall on the on your side of things. Talent typically wins out, especially someone who's got a track record and history of proving playing with that talent. But man, it's not looking good right now for him. And I haven't, you know, there's usually lots of avenues of where you can hear people with opinions, people that have knowledge of these types of things, what they think is going wrong, what they think he's doing wrong, what he could be doing better, how he could fix his problems, you know, but I really haven't heard anything. People seem to be just about as dumbfounded as Duffy himself. there's not a ton of answers out there. And it's that might be the most disconcerting part. You know, what happened and how do you fix it? Because that's kind of the bigger step, step two right there. How do you fix it? But, I don't know.
If you don't know where the biggest mistake is, you don't know how to fix that. So that is an important question that they need to solve. He's been all right tonight, but, you know, it's not like that hasn't happened before and then things fall apart. So I don't know. I don't have an answer. I don't think it's necessarily tipping pitches. But, you know, if he doesn't have confidence in a pitch, you know, what's the difference? I mean, you don't really have to tip middle slider. You know, if a guy sees that and he's a big leaguer, he's going to hurt it. So, you know, you could tell him it's a fastball and still throw that same pitch and they're probably going to hit it pretty hard. So I don't know. It's an important question. It's probably going to tank his trade value for this year just because it is such a question. And the Royals would be asking for a lot. So, for a guy with a couple more years with some question marks popping up this season, the Royals with big demands. Yeah. He's probably not going anywhere this year. So we'll see how he rebounds and then what happens from there, but or if he rebounds.
Yeah.
It's rough. Knows? And when that's supposed to be your ace, you know, right now it's Jake Junis and a bunch of fives, you know, a bunch of guys with 5.5, 5.8, 6.2 ERA. It's rough. It looks like that 2002 team that we talked about a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, it does.
Paul Bird and a bunch of junk.
Yeah. It's not promising right now.
No.
So hopefully, you know, Duffy, if he can continue with what he's doing tonight, have a solid performance, maybe he can kind of build on that because he's got time to rebuild his trade value. It's just we haven't seen any signs that he will. So hopefully he does. But so that's kind of been it for the Royals. Just not a ton. They're just kind of very businesslike in their ability to lose games. So just been kind of that way. So, you know, I think one thing that I kind of want to cover before we, that's not related to the Royals necessarily, before we get to Clint, is the kind of new method that the Tampa Bay Rays have used here. So the Tampa Bay Rays have decided that they are going to have relievers start the game, go for an inning, maybe two, and then bring in their quote-unquote starter, but had the expectation being to go for fewer innings, you know, in that 5-6 category, bringing you to, you know, seventh, eighth inning, and then you can just go to your closer from that point, assuming you have the lead, of course. And they recently tried this out with Sergio Romo being the guy to start the first inning. He did it two games in a row.
Right.
He pitched an inning, and then he pitched an inning in a third. They won the first game, lost the second. So, you know, who knows? I haven't really been following the rest of the few games, but I've been kind of busy this week, so I haven't been able to follow a ton to see if they've continued doing that method and how it's worked out for them. But regardless, it's been kind of a, I don't know if you say hot button issue, but it's been kind of an interesting issue to bring up in the baseball community. And one of the interesting aspects of it that I like that people have talked about is this idea that, and you sent me the article Joe Posnanski wrote, and this was his kind of take on it, where the most efficient method to win a baseball game, finding what that is the job of the baseball player and the baseball manager. But the result of implementing that specific strategy or whatever it may be doesn't always equate to being in the best interest of the fans. So
yeah, it's not always, you know, fun.
And if you can, and he brought up a good point, you know, talking about basketball way back in the 80s when the game was really slow and the foul calls, you know, the definitions of a foul, et cetera, were really lax. So it was a very physical game. People would hold the ball. They would dribble it out for, you know, until the very last few seconds of the shot clock. Every single possession made for a boring game. People didn't like watching it. So they changed a lot of the rules and sped it up, made it more offensive, and it exploded in popularity. Also kind of helped that they had Michael Jordan come along at that time. But, you know, that's really kind of interesting because we see this argument too with the shift, because we're talking about that. We talked about it last year. We talked about it in the offseason, and they're talking about it again now because the shifts are getting more pronounced to not only I mean, you know, it used to be that, you know, the third baseman would kind of go over by second base. But now, I mean, teams are, depending on who the player is, teams are literally shifting, you know, well, every single player well onto the first base side.
Yeah.
Essentially daring the player, do something about it. Hit it over there. We're not there. We don't think you're going to do it. We don't think you're good enough to control where you go. We think you're too busy trying to hit a home run and pull the ball that you're going to just pull it right into us, and that's what we're going to do. And, you know, even if you hit a line drive, just a rope that would have normally been a hit, if a defense was playing, you know, where they typically are, but because of the, you know, it's like, well, I hit the ball well and I hit it where I'm supposed to, but because of the shift, I didn't get a hit. And it's so interesting because there's all these different dynamics of, you know, what's best for the game, what's best for the fans, and, you know, whose responsibility is it to factor all this in? And I don't know. I think it's a really fascinating discussion happening right now. And personally, I like both the shift and the way what the Rays have done with starting relievers first. You know, that's one of the aspects of sports that I think are really interesting. When teams try and find and employ new strategies that people haven't really thought of yet that help you win, that are, you know, unique and different, I love that. I think that's great. And you find, you can say, okay, you know, this is something that we've discovered. We're going to implement it, and it helps us win games. And, you know, so many things that are just commonplace in baseball right now started that way. You know, I mean, and there was a time when your starter essentially had to go nine innings. You know, I mean,
had seven pitchers.
Yeah, they had to go nine innings. And if, you know, they were just kind of out there. And then, you know, the manager started saying, okay, I'm going to carry more pitchers. I don't need my pitcher to go nine innings. Go seven innings, and then I'll bring in this other guy who can go two innings, you know, or six innings and go three, whatever the case may be. But, and then that evolved into, you know, four pitchers in an inning based on lefty, righty, all this kind of business. And now, you know, that's where we are now. So a lot of that, all these kind of things happen from people breaking the mold. I think that's kind of cool. But, you know, there's lots of people that say, oh, we should outlaw the shift. It's making baseball, you know, it's less balls in play, it's less exciting, all that kind of stuff. And I get that argument. I don't necessarily disagree with it, but I don't know. I think it's really interesting, and I'm a fan of these things because I also think the onus becomes on your opponent. You know, it's like when I was in grade school and I played basketball, right? I mean, it was terrible. I was terrible. but every time they told us, okay, 80% of the world is right-handed. So if you're guarding somebody on defense, shade them to the right. Leave your left side open. Mm-hmm. Dare them to drive with their left hand, especially at the grade school level, you know?
It's right, like, I imagine it probably works pretty well.
Exactly. Dare them to do it. And nobody ever did. They always tried to go right, you know? And if you found that one kid who was ahead of the curve and could go left, your team was going to be really good. But it's that same deal. It's, you know, hit it to the left side of the field. Hit it to the third base side of second base. I mean, you just hit a dribbler and you'll get a double. And we saw a couple weeks ago, you know, Whit Merrifield stole a base because the shift, he's just like, well, I'm just going to steal. I'm just going to take this bag if nobody's going to be there. You know, people are playing the shift so hard. So I'm all for that. But it's a really interesting discussion right now. Where do you come out on all this?
See, I'm with you. I like when teams try to like play around with these things and try different things because, you know, like you said, the game evolves. You know, the game kind of does its own thing. You went from the years where Don Drysdale would throw, you know, 9 innings every time out to Raleigh Fingers would come in and pitch 2 1/3 to Dennis Eckersley going 1/3 of an inning or, you know, a whole inning to close it out. And it's just an evolution. As that's kind of happened, managers have prioritized going with bullpen guys instead of having more guys on the bench to work platoon matchups, which, you know, is a whole other thing. So it's like, you know, if that's what they feel like is what gives them the best chance to get reliable matchups, that's what they do. And, you know, not a lot of people lament having a lack of platoon situations or late inning pinch hits. You know, it's just kind of one of those things. But for this kind of idea in particular, I think is interesting because it's the Rays who came out in spring training and they were saying they wanted to do a 4-man rotation and then they would do a bullpen day, which is just kind of like, if you've got the guys in the bullpen who can cover 2+ innings sometimes, and you don't necessarily like your starting options, I think it's a valid way to try to approach it. Plus if you get the days off to work out right, you can get some of the starters that you do like more starts and more innings and get your best players in there. Plus, you know, within the game, within that bullpen game, you can do, you know, matchups much earlier. But the main kind of thing that they're doing for this particular one was they've started Romo because the Angels, their opponent in that series, were very right-hand heavy at the top of the lineup. And in one particular game, the quote starter was a lefty. And so it's like, do you want your lefty starter to be facing like Justin Upton and Mike Trout and those guys? No. No, thank you. I would rather throw a righty against those guys. So that's where Romo steps in, and he gets through those first three guys, and then you follow it up with your lefty. And he goes his 5 innings, and now he only has to face Trout and those guys maybe 2 times through the lineup, and you're through 7 innings. I think it's perfectly valid. I understand how some people might not like it because it's different. You know, Saris at The Athletic mentioned that, you know, if you're using a good reliever who's good enough to start in that kind of spot, you don't have him later, which is true. The first inning is a lower leverage inning as compared to the 6th, 7th, or 8th inning, which again is true. But if you can kind of hack that matchup and you have the right personnel to do it, I think it's worth a shot. Now, I don't think most teams will do it or even try it. But I think if you have the right kind of mix of bullpen arms, you can give it a whirl, you know, and the Rays are in a position where they're not expected to win. They might as well try it, see if it's something that works out. And if it turns out that they develop a bunch of relievers who can go 2 innings, maybe it's a more viable strategy down the line that they can try out later. And then you don't have to develop so many, you know, badass starting pitchers. You know, you don't need that Mets rotation to 2015. You can just go and get a bunch of guys who can cover 2 or 3 innings and maybe one guy who can cover 1 inning, you know, on certain days, and you're fine. You know, you're totally fine. You got everything covered. So I think it's interesting. I don't think a lot of teams will use it, but I think some teams will maybe be more open to trying it. It's kind of similar to that, the bullpen argument of like 2016 in the playoffs where like every team was using multiple, you know, relievers for multiple innings. And we all decided, no, that's not sustainable over a full season. And it's probably not. But if you do it every 5th day or every 10th day, maybe it's fine. You know, if you've got guys and you have nothing to lose, or if, you know, if it's something that minimizes your risk of that 5th starter facing an optimized lineup from the start, you know, there it is. And if nothing else, the other team, you know, if they don't like it, they can adjust. you know, hit those guys 3, 4, 5, 6.
Yeah, there's no rule against you adjusting to that.
Right. If you have a feeling they're going to do it, you know, it's like the shift. Hit it to the other side.
Yeah. You know? Seems so simple.
Right. Right. And it's hard to pull the trigger and it's, you know, little cat and mouse. But, you know, at the same time, it's just like, you know, every action gets a reaction and you can either keep hitting your head against the wall or you can take a step to the right and walk through the doorway. And it's like, if those guys don't want to adjust, why help them out? You know, like if they're going to just keep hitting it to the second baseman in shallow right, why move him? I mean, it doesn't make any sense. So I'm fine with it. Like I think it's interesting. I think it's interesting if other teams maybe pick up on it. I don't know that many will, but now that a team has tried it, yeah. I mean, I could totally see it working. I could even see it if something like, you know, Jason Hamill always has that difficult time the third time through an order. But a lot of times he's cruising through and he's through five or almost through five and Ned wants to keep him in to get the win. Hey, if he's the second pitcher, he can still get the win even if he only pitches four innings. Just because that's the rule for a pitcher win, which is another ridiculous thing, but tangentially related to this.
Yes.
So, you know, even if you're a manager like that, it kind of falls into the same type of category.
Mm-hmm. And there are some even people that are going the route of saying that it's a scummy practice by the Rays because it's done to drive down pitcher wins and lower arbitration values, which...
I mean,
you know,
maybe. I guess I get the argument, but
I can see, yeah. If you say that's an unintended negative result, okay, I'll buy that. If you say the Rays are doing this for that reason, I think that's an absurd argument. Personally.
I agree. I'm in the same boat.
I think the Rays are just trying. They don't have a very good team, and I think they're trying to win games and do whatever they need to do. So I don't fall on that side of the argument, but it is an interesting point that is, as far as an unintended consequence, that could be it. But then, you know, maybe this will force changing to the archaic pitcher win model. You know, maybe instead of, you know, who pitched what are, you know, what the five innings or, you know, through the fifth inning or whatever the hell the rules are now.
Right.
You know, maybe it becomes, you know, who pitched the most innings in the game, who had the most, you know, whatever. I don't know. But it's something that could be looked at in the future. But another interesting thing that Joe Posnanski mentioned in his article, and he mentioned it about his time when he was in Kansas City covering the Royals, and he talked about how Bob McClure, when he was pitching coach for the Royals, had a similar idea where he would basically say, okay, if you have three pitchers who can go three innings each, you know, we should do that. You could do that 4 times in a row or 4 days in a row. And, you know, you would essentially cut down. It's a similar type scenario. And a lot of it would, I think part of that, the impetus behind that was because the Royals had a lot of pitchers in the early 2000s when McClure was pitching coach that were very Jason Hamill-esque in the sense that you might think they could be having an okay game and doing all right, and then things would just fall apart and they get shelled one inning, you know, and it maybe it was just related to they can't keep it up for that long. Maybe it was related to second, third time through the order, whatever the case may be. But, you know, that was something that could alleviate it. And apparently he was just kind of laughed out of the room every time he brought it up. But now here we are almost 20 years later, and the Rays are trying something of a similar – something a strategy in a similar vein to that. So, you know, baseball is notorious for how long it takes things to kind of break through and change to happen in that regard. But I thought that was interesting because I had not heard that before. You know, obviously McClure's time in Kansas City, social media was non-existent. So it was basically just everything you had from the beat reporters and the opinion writers and everything and the people like the Posnanskis and the Mellingers of the world. And, you know, if they didn't think something was interesting enough to pass along, then we just didn't hear it. You know, that's kind of the way it was. So, whereas now you don't have to write a full story. You can just throw out a tweet like, hey, this heard this interesting anecdote and it's out there. But regardless, so I hadn't heard that. And I thought that was really interesting that, you know, someone on the Royals had brought that up. And of course, you know, not only is baseball slow to adapt, but I think Royals are on the slower side of that even to adapt to new strategies. So any idea of trying to revolutionize the pitching, how a pitching staff is used, it's not surprising that that McClure would have been laughed out of the room when he presented this possible possible avenue. But it's interesting. I think it's a really interesting time right now, and I think people are just going to start to get more and more creative with these types of things. I mean, we saw last year the Cubs do it where they would have their pitcher just move to the outfield. And so they could put him back in, you know, for the next batter. If they just had one batter they didn't want to face, they didn't want him to face or whatever, you know. So that's something that obviously, you know, I think that happened, used to happen a lot more 50, 60 years ago or whatever. But, and it happens occasionally, but it just another reason for people being like, hey, you know, we don't have to abide by these quote unquote unwritten rules and these archaic things anymore. If there's nothing that objectively prevents it in the baseball rule book, then let's try it. It's going to help us win. You know, I love that. I think it's fun.
I mean, it's not too far off from when, you know, you start hitting the pitcher eighth to kind of, you know, cycle the order through differently.
Yeah.
Or, you know, whereas anymore, you know, your best hitter a lot of times is batting second. You know, just because it gets them more at-bats. I mean, it's a totally logical way to approach a problem. How do we get this guy to have more at-bats? Let's hit him a spot higher. You know, how do we get this guy to have more base runners in front of him? Well, the second time through the order, maybe he's got one more potential batter to reach. So those kind of things. And it's like those small little edges can add up a whole lot of times. You know, I mean, I don't know how you would enforce rules against those kind of things. You know, pitcher or a manager can decide when he wants to change pitchers. He can decide who he wants to start the game. He can decide if he wants to shift everybody behind the first baseman if he wants to. You know, it's their prerogative. I don't know how you would create a rule that would adjust that. It just seems like that's tinkering way too much to me. So I don't know. I'm all for it. I mean, go for it. Try what you want.
Yeah, because give it a shot. Then you have an element of it being just like kind of like just whining. It feels like if you were to outlaw the shift, like when Kareem Abdul-Jabbar got into the NBA way back when, and they outlawed the dunk, right? No, it's illegal. You can't dunk anymore. It's like, well, that's dumb. You know that. You know, that's kind of the way it feels right now, where this shift thing, players just gets unfair. And I can kind of get that as well, where you know, if you have a really good – if you make really great contact and you hit the ball to a place like I was talking about earlier that would normally be a hit, and it's not a hit because of this massive shift, I would be pissed too. I'd be like, man, I put a great, you know, great contact on that ball. But at the same time, it's just then like baseball saying, well, we don't think enough players can – hit against the shift to the other side, so we're just going to make it, we're just going to outlaw it. And it's like, I feel like that's dumb. I feel like there should be, because every strategy is a counter strategy, so, you know, it's harder to implement because it's just really hard to hit a baseball, number one, but hard to choose where you hit a baseball. But at the same time, you know, if you know there's nobody over there, you don't have to hit it as hard. You can try and you can slow your or you can try and, you know, change your swing to be a little bit more, just be like, I just got to make contact over in that direction. Doesn't matter how hard I hit it, because it's going to be a hit no matter what. Just essentially like a bunt. So, yeah, it's a really interesting time. I'm excited to see how these things come out and how baseball deals with them. I think that'll be a fun thing to watch, especially because the Royals haven't been all that fun to watch. So that'll be kind of fun for the rest of the season. So for now, we're going to take a quick break, and we're going to go when we come back. We're going to have Clint Scholes. If you've been following BP Kansas City, which you should, know that he has just been pounding out these draft articles. Tons of great stuff. Tons of great analysis. Again, I don't know how many times we can say it, but it's it's truer and truer every time.
Follow
Nobody
Clint.
Does it better. Nobody does it better than Clint in terms of. Information on prospects and different things like that. So stay tuned. We'll be right back. We'll have that interview with Clint Scholes from BP Kansas City right on the other side.
The Kansas City Baseball Vault will be right back after these messages.
Throw to first. And George Brett is picked off first. And even his wife is embarrassed. Congratulations to George Brett, who in the seventh inning here at Anaheim Stadium tonight gets his 3,000th career hit.
The Vault.
Hey, Troy, what are you doing this weekend?
I'm going to grab a beer somewhere. What do you have in mind?
I heard about this awesome new bar downtown. It's called Rage. The waitresses have a contest to see who has the most piercing.
Oh, man, that's not really my scene.
Well, there's another bar close by called Spit Cup. Check it out. The bartenders wear chaps, and every hour they shoot a guy.
No, seriously, I just want a bar where I can sit down and watch the game.
Okay, I've got just the place. It's called Lilac. You sit on pillows, and you drink from eucalyptus leaves.
No, Ned, but I just want a place where I can get a cheap drink and watch the football game.
Okay, I got it. This place, it's got a TV. It's called 816.
Libidotosis.
Yep.
All their drinks come in NBA hats.
Man, I just want a place like Kelly's.
Oh, you mean Kelly's Westport Inn? No, they've got all the basketball and bowl game. They've even got a heated roof. The view is really nice, too, if you know what I'm saying. Why didn't you just say you wanted to go to Kelly's?
Kelly's Westport Inn, 500 Westport Road. Make it your place to go any time of the week.
And welcome back into the Kansas City Baseball Vault. Hope you enjoyed that brief little break. We're here for the second segment and really excited to cover some of this material. As you probably know, the Major League Baseball draft starts on June 4th. And what better way to prepare for that than to bring on Baseball Prospectus Kansas City's own Clint Scholes. He is our prospect expert. And he is going to be here on this episode to talk about the Royals, the draft, their draft pool, and just to kind of give a preview to our listeners about what to expect. How's it going, Clint?
Going well, Mike.
So the obvious thing that we all kind of know, and that you know, as soon as the offseason hit last year, we knew that the Royals were going to have some pretty good draft pool allotments. And lo and behold, after Lorenzo Cain and Eric Hosmer both signed away, the Royals come away with the top draft pool in this year's draft, despite picking 18th. So what kind of unique opportunities might they have with that kind of, you know, money to pull from on top of the number of picks that they have in those first few rounds?
Well, when you talk about the draft pool, I think it says they've got 11.8, a little bit more than that is what they say. But then you have a 10% overage without a penalty in there. So they really have a little over $14 million to spend in total. So that's where we start. Since I've been following this team, the most they've ever spent was the 2011 draft, with Bubba getting 7 or 7.5, I don't remember what he got, was right around that $14 million mark. So when you're talking about the amount of money available to them, they have a chance to set a franchise record, basically, or right around, match it. You never know with a lot of the lower round guys what they end up with. If it's, you know, some guys get 15, 20 grand, some guys get 100. If they get 100 or more, you generally find out through Baseball America and MLB Pipeline what they end up with, but you don't know about the lesser amount. So first off, we're talking about a team that's pretty much in the bottom third of all prospects, you know, rankings, usually the bottom two, if we're going to be honest about it. But I don't think the system's as bad as what people led on. I think you got two to three guys right now that are legit top 100 prospects already in the system. But anyway, with the $14 million, they've got eight picks in the top 152. So you're talking about a very deep draft this year. It's very deep, but it's not top loaded. Like, it doesn't have a Bryce Harper, Steven Strasburg, somebody like that. But it's got a defined top pick, I think, but just not real top, but then extremely deep into, you should be able to get talent well into the 200th range. And I think the Royals have all told about 10 picks in the top 200. So, and they've got four in the top 40 and six in the top 100. So they should be able to take a bottom, you know, farm system and really revamp it just with the draft. And then that doesn't bring into what they do internationally and the trade market. So it kind of gives you an overview.
Yeah. And so, like, last year they had, you know, what I would consider a pretty successful draft when you consider Nick Prado and MJ Melendez have definitely broken out to be guys. Would they be two of those three that you would say would be top 100 right now? I would guess those two and Khalil Lee or maybe Matias in there.
I would say Prado's on the outside. I'd say Melendez, who, I mean, everybody that's watching him has just raved of you. Reviews about this guy, not myself included. I'm talking people outside of me.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, Melendez, Matias, and Lee are the three guys I like the most. And then Prado's probably on the outside. He's probably the fourth guy there.
Yeah. Not a bad honorable mention, but
no. And the problem with him is position. I mean, prospect rankings have taken that into consideration more than ever before. And so that hurts him.
So looking at those guys, those are all A-ball level guys. So when we're talking about the Royals, their next really great players are still a couple years away. So looking at this draft in particular, does that impact the way they might approach it? Are they just going to, you know, see who's available at that pick and take the guy that they like? Or do you think that they're going to focus more on, you know, college guys who might be hitting the same stride as those guys, or maybe more high school guys to be a second wave behind Matias, Prado, et cetera? Or, you know, is it just going to be a mix of, you know, this guy's available, we're going to go with that guy?
I think that's the way you take it. You should take every draft. Here's our board. Here's our top rated player. That's who we're taking, regardless of position, regardless of college, high school, you know, pitcher, position player, all that. You should take the best player on the board because you never know how things are going to lay out as far as what players are doing in the major leagues, what guys are doing in the minor leagues. If you have five catchers that are all out top 100 catchers, not that that would ever happen, but let's say you did, well, those are high tradable commodities now, and you can turn those players into other products. So the way the draft lays out, how I see the draft this year, it's extremely deep in high school talented pitching. College position players, it's a kind of a down class. There's some good college pitchers at the top end, talented pitchers. And then there's a kind of not a real strong high school position players, but there's definitely some intriguing ones. So so that's kind of how the draft lays out. And it kind of meets what the Royals need. The Royals really lack in starting pitching from top to bottom in the system. Right now, the only guy you would consider a front of the line, a possible front of the line rotation guy in the entire system is Carlos Hernandez down in Lexington, who started today. Other than that, unless there's a Dominican guy that's going to really shine on the radar, then, or a guy that they drafted last year that hasn't broke with a team yet, then there's nobody really in the system that is a top of a possible front of the rotation starter. So that's what they really need. And it fits this draft well. So kind of, you never want to draft for need, but for what the Royals need and how this draft strengths out, it meets. That's the thing. You can, with prep pitchers, especially right-handed prep pitchers, what we've seen is that's a high failure rate at the top end. The Royals have dealt with it as well with Ash Russell and guys in the past. So generally, you can get a quality, talented player in that 33 to 58 range that they have there. So they can wait. They can afford to wait there at 18. But if there's an extremely talented player like an Ethan Hankins, who's thought to be a top five prospect going into this draft, who dealt with a little bit of injury prior to his season, or during his season at the start, and then has came on late, then that's a formula that they've used in the past and they could use again. So someone like that at 18, as far as a prep pitcher goes, a guy that I really like and would prefer if he was available, I don't think he'll be available, is Ryan Weathers, a left-hander out of Tennessee. He's David Weathers, who pitched in the majors for about 19 years' son. He's a left-handed pitcher, and what we've seen in the past, left-handed pitchers have a little bit better success rate than right-handed pitchers, especially prep pitchers. So that's a guy there. And then it's really with the amount of money that they and the Rays have, they could really shove some guys to them if they really wanted to. If they really liked a guy, you would think if they really liked a guy right now, they could go to his agent and say, here, we've got 18, but we're going to give you top five, top seven pick money. And then that player just has to put that out there to the teams that are picking in those spots and tell them, here, you're going to have to basically, when you look at the math, you're going to have to give me about 70% of your pool to some of those teams. And a lot of teams just aren't going to be willing to do that, even if they had a guy at that top, because that just destroys your draft and you end up not getting the depth of talent. And this is a draft that you want a depth of talent. The Royals could do that. I don't know if they will. I wouldn't do that myself with the depth in this draft, but they could. So those are a couple pitchers. There's so many pitchers. And I think the better strategy is take the best player that you have at 18, whoever that is, no matter, regardless of position, and then play for one of the prep pitchers later, to me, at 33, 34, 40, and 58.
So a lot of the guys who, at least lately in the last week or so that I've noticed, a lot of like outfielders, and I think is it high school outfielders, are those kind of the guys who are getting linked to the Royals at 18 lately? Is that kind of similar? I know Jordan Adams is someone that you've mentioned a lot about, you know, probably being a really likely pick at 18, but, you know, is that the general sense that you get from kind of what you've observed and heard about so far?
Jordan Adams is just that guy that fits the Royals' MO, I mean, of what they like. You're talking an 80 runner, good strength. He's a football player. He's a four-star wide receiver, already committed to North Carolina, where his dad's a coach there. Blazing fast, had a great national high school showcase tournament that plays in North Carolina, and it was – they were the first host school, like high school, to make it to the championship game. It was basically off the strength of Jordan Adams and what he was doing. You're kind of looking at a Byron Buxton type with Jordan there. So knowing the Royals' MO, they love football players.
Right.
They love speed, center field guy, up the middle talent. So that's a guy that I've talked to a scout outside, or I've talked to a amateur scout outside the organization that says that's their guy. So we'll see. Another guy that you've seen in some mocks, Jared Kalanick from Wisconsin, kid I really like. I wrote up earlier in the year. High baseball IQ, despite being from Wisconsin, because he does. His dad owns a training facility there, so he gets to use it all the time. The thing with him, Wisconsin doesn't have a high success rate historically, which does that matter? I don't know, but you're talking about a other kid. And then the other thing is there's some doubt about whether he can stick in center field, if there's any kind of doubt there, then I wouldn't think the Royals would be interested, because just historically they like up the middle players, and you're talking about a first round pick there at 18 that might have to move to a corner. You really wouldn't want to do that. So those are the kind of the guys. I think you got some college guys in play there. I wouldn't be shocked if they went with like a Grayson Janista from Wichita State, if they wanted to pay a little bit less to reserve money for that bigger pool of players at 33, 34, and 40, and 58, and all that. Or I wouldn't be shocked if maybe a guy who, I don't know if this would be an overdraft at 18, but Griffin Conine had a terrible start to his season and then came on huge late. He was probably a top 15 pick prior to the season, but then he got off to such a poor start that he really fell down the boards, and now he's making a resurgence. So does he resurge up to that point to where you could logically pick him at 18? I don't know. But those are some of the guys, that just a few of the names. It's going to be interesting in how they strategize it. For as much as you see with the mocks, people need to remember, I can't remember, Mike, maybe you do, of a mock draft getting it right with their first pick.
Beyond like those, you know, those three stars and the, you know, the Machado types, the Strasburg type, you know, where there's three elite guys in a certain point, maybe 2012, they kind of got a couple of those top five picks right. But, you know, even then, Danny Holson screwed up that 2012 draft, or the 2011 draft, I mean.
Yeah. I mean, everybody thought they were going to get whatever pitcher was left over.
Mm-hmm.
Because everybody thought Bubba would be off the board already. And then it broke out where the pitchers were all taken and Bubba was on the board. And so then it was just logical, well, you take him. I can't think of a draft they've nailed their top pick. I've hit on some of their second rounds. I have had Foster Griffin. Sean Newcourt had him taking Chase Vallot before. J.J. Piccola had him taking Will Myers as their first-round pick, but then they ended up getting him in the third round. So it's not that they don't get picks that they get correct, but I can't think of one that they've gotten correct with their first-round pick. And that's not to say that, you know, that's a lot of that the board doesn't lay out like you thought, but a lot of that is the Royals are very tight-lipped. Mm-hmm. They're tight-lipped with their scouts on a pro level and on an amateur level. And so I've had guys, scouts from other organizations, tell me before, like when I say, well, the scout said they're taking Jordan Adams. Well, no offense, but that scout's got their last 2 years wrong. So, so take it with a grain of salt and how you take it. I mean, that's just how they do things. And, you know, I'm a Patriots fan. It's a very Patriot way of doing things.
Well, and even when you're picking 18th, it's like so much can change. They can have a guy that they know dead to rights they want to take. You know, it just takes one team to step in and mess that up. And, it, you know, no matter how dead set they might be on, say, Jordan Adams, if someone ahead of them wants him, well, the Royals obviously don't get the opportunity. So when you talk to, you know, Royals personnel and, you know, any scouts, do they ever give you any sort of hint? Do you ever have any kind of idea? Yeah, I mean, they're notoriously tight. I mean, they just don't leak that much. But, you know, you've got some rapport with some of these guys. Do they, you know, give you any kind of hint aside from just knowing the type of players they usually like?
None. They won't give me. I had been thinking Dantillo last year. Well, you know how I got that information? I sat behind Lonnie Goldberg at a Dantillo start. Lonnie's, you know, he's the scouting director. He's the guy making the call. He's not going to go to a guy's start that he's not interested in. Mm-hmm. You know, he's got to see the top guys. Well, you know, it's Dantillo. So that's how I knew that information. I sat behind him. I talked. So But no, they're very tight-lipped. I mean, a little bit it's myself, too. I don't ask them. I mean, that's their job. I don't
– Sure.
It's not – you know, our site isn't based on that. People go to Baseball America for that information, that little inside tidbit. You know, I'll pass along stuff that I hear, but I don't think they come to our site for that. I mean, maybe just because then you got more national people that are doing that. Speaking to the Jordan Adams thing, when we talk about Jordan Adams, you're talking about a player who's a four-star wide receiver from college. So, and his dad coaches at that school. So the reason I'm not high on Jordan Adams is because the extra money you're talking about giving him.
Mm-hmm.
Is Jordan Adams a top 20 talent? Well, not according to a couple of sites. I mean, he did come on late. Some do think he's that. Some don't. So now you're talking about paying extra in a deep draft to get a kid to come to join your organization. So you're paying extra in a deep draft to essentially not pay for talent, but to pay for a guy to join your organization. So you're basically tossing away one to two players to join your organization. I don't like that. That's why I would pass on him. There's other guys that are similar talents, like a Joe Gray Jr. from Mississippi, who's a legit center fielder, has a strong arm. He just doesn't have that 80 grade speed. He's probably a 60, 65, maybe he turns into a 70 speed guy. But he's a better hitter. He's hit for longer in showcases, and so there's a lot of failure rate mixed in there with their Jordan Adams player. And what we've seen with football players who take away some of those reps is that they take extra development time, and that's not something that the Royals don't have to give, but that's just a longer path, and now that ceiling starts to cut away. That's what we saw with Bubba.
Mm-hmm.
This was a meet when Bubba was drafted. This was a five-tool guy, hit 300, 40 home runs, play elite center field, and then we saw almost immediately that stuff started to peel away. That onion peeled away as far as the ceiling, and so Jordan Adams, there's a lot of probabilities there, but I just don't like that. I don't like giving extra.
Yeah, if you don't have to spend another $1 million just because he has that type of leverage, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense when there are comparable players. One guy who's as I was going back over some of the things you've written, you mentioned Griffin Conine earlier, but one of his teammates at Duke, obviously not a high school kid like Jordan Adams, but he kind of seems, I mean, the speed may not be there, but he seems to have some kind of profile that the Royals would like with, you know, maybe a little more contact instead of power. You know, is that something that they might look at, some kind of, you know, maybe sneak him in also, or is he anywhere close to what they might be looking at?
What, like Jimmy Herron?
Jimmy Herron, yeah, that's... I didn't mention his name. I guess that helps.
Jimmy's a good player. He's a high on base guy, which that's an interesting thing. I mean, that we're seeing in the low minors right now, not the guys at A ball, but Khalil Lee, Rudy Martin, these guys that are really drawing a lot of walks, Nicky Lopez. So Jimmy Herron he's not a guy that you'd take in the first two rounds. He's probably a third, fourth round type guy. But high baseball IQ, good plate approach. You're looking at maybe a 280, 350 type hitter there, play the left field, maybe some fringe center. But just that profile, high baseball IQ with a high propensity to take pitches and work pitch counts. What we're seeing with what guys that they've added as of late with Nicky Lopez and Michael Gigliotti, who they added last year. Do they go out and find another guy like that that's going to take a lot of pitches and work the count, and maybe he has a chink in the armor, which we saw with both Nicky and Gigliotti before he got injured, is that they play up the middle, which we've already mentioned they love.
Mm-hmm.
They're great defenders, they take pitches. The only chink in their armor maybe is that they're not power guys. They don't have much to any power. Nicky's probably 30, 35 power, and Gigliotti's maybe 40 on the scale, on the scout scale. So do they go out and find a similar player like that? There's a guy from Dallas Baptist that probably fits that mold. So I'd be interested to see, is this going to become something that they look to find in many drafts, and something that maybe Lonnie's latched onto, that, hey, this is a good type of player that we can find. And I think there's guys like that in every draft.
So specifically for this year, I mean, we've talked about the Royals have plenty of capital to work with. They have a lot of picks. There's a deep draft. So aside from just the typical injuries and, you know, just guys who just don't make it, which always happens in every draft, what kind of things – you already talked about, like, paying extra for a guy like Jordan Adams, but what other things – or what types of players would they take that you would say they screwed it up? Like, how do they mess this up? I'm feeling pessimistic maybe if I look back at a couple of previous drafts. How do they mess this up? Can they mess it up? Is it foolproof? Are they on the right track?
It's definitely not foolproof. I think we can look at the 2015 draft and realize that any draft that they make is not going to be foolproof.
Right.
I think what you want to avoid, and what I would avoid, with so many deep pitchers, I mentioned Ethan Higgins, comes off an injury. Mike Vassell, another guy from Boston that's come off an injury. The Royals have taken guys that have been injured in high school, John Lamb, or been injured prior to the draft, Kyle Zimmer, guy that they've gotten extended right now that's dealing with shoulder issues, Evan Steele. They've taken guys who have been injured. There's been others too, and their ceiling is limited, and they're constantly dealing with injuries. Scott Blewett hasn't been dealing with injuries throughout his career, but he's never turned into the pitcher that they'd hoped. So I would avoid those guys. There's guys to avoid there. Hankins, Vassell. I mean, and I like Vassell as a pitcher. He's got very good control, which is something that the Royals need, and he's got plus pitches. Hankins has some very plus pitches. Mason Denneberg, same thing. Good fastball, developing breaking ball, good changeup, very limited pitching, so there should be a ceiling there. But I would avoid those guys based on their history and their lack of being able to develop those guys after injury. So that's where I would stay away from. That's the biggest pet peeve to me. There's other guys that are available in this pitching draft that you don't need to take those players. And then the other thing I would take more than they do is I would look at corner outfield, or just corners in general, that they typically stay away from those players. Not that they don't take them, but if you look in the history, Anderson Miller was a corner outfielder and he hasn't had much success. But they don't take those guys. They really don't. If you're not an up-the-middle player and profile kind of as an up-the-middle player, they don't take those guys high. And I think with Griffin Conine and other players that are going to be available possibly, that I wouldn't pass up on those guys if they're there. Trevor Larnach from Oregon State is a powerful corner. Janista, who I mentioned before, he probably moves to a corner. If they're there and you can get good value, I wouldn't pass them up. And that's something that they haven't taken a lot of those guys. So change it up that way too.
Last question, then we'll let you go. Is there any pick that you think might surprise people by falling to 18? Is there someone, you know, you kind of mentioned with Hankins, top five maybe talent, but is there someone who a lot of people are talking about going top three, four, five, who might just keep sliding that the Royals might have opportunity to get?
Maybe Shane McClanahan from South Florida. He's a top 10 ranked player. He's been top 10 all year, but his control and command has really suffered. He didn't have a good start today. I mean, this is a guy, a lefty, who throws, and this is pretty rare because with college guys, they generally don't fall. But this is a guy who's struggled with control and command for most of his career, but he throws upper 90s, has a good changeup. It's like, I mean, as far as pitches go, you're talking top of the line, maybe as good as anybody in this draft, but his control and command are not great. I don't think he'd slide to 18, but I wouldn't be shocked if he slid further back than what some people think at this point, just because there's some question marks there as far as his control and command. I would like to see some, you know, a prep position player like Nolan Gorman from Arizona, big power, huge power. We're talking Moustakas-level power from high school. If I could have my druthers, that's who I – if the Royals are going to go up and pony up for a kid and say, here, we're going to back up the truck for you to get you to, pick, to get you to our pick, that's who I would like for them to do that to. And he, if you've watched any of the highlights of the perfect game, all-star game last year, he turned on 96 inside and just backed it to right center field. I mean, and it's just so smooth. So smooth. I would love to see him playing with Sully and Nick Prado and those guys. But I don't think he'll get to that point.
All right. So the MLB draft is on June 4th. Everybody out there should really be following Clint already. But if not, on Twitter, it's just Clint Scholes, S-C-O-L-E-S. And Clint also writes the minor league recap every day at Baseball Prospectus Kansas City. So on top of all this draft prep that you've done, you're also paying attention to everything that happens in the minor league. So busy week. I'm going to let you go. And we'll probably have you back on after the draft to see if they get Gorman and Janista and all these other guys that, that you like so much. But thanks for your time, Clint. As always, we just benefit from your expertise so much.
No problem, Mike. Anytime. I'll talk to you guys later.
So, yeah, thank you very much to Clint Scholes there for coming on the show. Great stuff from him. Lots, as we said, you know, before, earlier in the show, doesn't get much better than Clint as far as knowledge of, again, for my money, any non-paid front office person having better knowledge of the farm system, I would find it hard to believe, and pretty close to hard to believe for just general knowledge of baseball, lower level baseball prospects, than Clint. So thank you very much, Clint Scholes, for coming on. Absolutely great. And then be sure to follow him on Twitter at Clint Scholes, and we'll definitely have him on again in a couple weeks to recap the draft on who the Royals actually picked. So looking forward to that, because that'll be really interesting to see where he thinks the Royals, how well he thinks the Royals did and where he thinks they're going to go for the future. Be sure to visit our sponsors. Go to BP Kansas City. Read up on if you didn't get if they didn't talk about somebody, you know, maybe you know so a few prospects and we weren't able to talk about them on the show now, then you know, I'm sure Clint has written about them in some capacity on the site. So go check out BP Kansas City and look at all Clint's stuff, you know, not only for the draft prospect thing, but, you know, also if you want to catch up on the Royals' current farm system, who they've already drafted or acquired, nobody better for that either. Clint's Diamonds in the Rough is always great, allows you to keep up on things. And if you follow him on Twitter, he's always tweeting out lots of fun little tidbits and different things about who's doing well in the minors, etc. So follow him. Read his stuff on BP Kansas City. Doesn't get any better for the prospect knowledge. Also go to Kelly's Westport Inn in Westport, of course. It's weather's getting nice.
And their block party. That's this weekend too. Just remembered when you said that. So
yes. And that'd be Sunday night.
Sunday night.
And
yeah.
We don't work. Nobody works on Monday. So you got all Monday to recover, and it's going to be, They block off the streets. Everyone's out in the street. Everything's going crazy with the block party. It's a fantastic time. So be sure to get out there and have some fun. Tell them the Baseball Vault sent you. But the Kelly's Westport Inn, always a great place. We'll be back next week, and then we'll be starting. We'll be even closer to the draft. So hopefully, you know, the Royals give us a few more bright spots to talk about. Maybe we can talk about Danny Duffy having a couple starts under his belt that were pretty good. He's still doing well so far at this point. So hopefully we'll have a few more bright spot things to talk about. So we'll see you next week. But thank you so much for stopping by. We love you all. Couldn't do it without you. Be sure to visit our sponsors. We'll see you next week. Until then, thanks for stopping by. And as always, go Royals.
Thank you for listening to the Kansas City Baseball Vault. You can follow us on Twitter at KC Baseball Vault. You can also find us on Baseball Prospectus Kansas City at bpkansascity.com. You can follow BPKC on Twitter at bprokansascity. Also, you can subscribe to the podcast through iTunes, through Stitcher, or whatever podcast app you like. And if you have any questions, comments, or if you just want to say hi, send those emails to KansasCityBaseballVault@gmail.com.